Welcome back, brothers and sisters, to another deep dive into the minds of history's greatest philosophers. After exploring the intriguing lives and teachings of Diogenes the Dog and Aristotle, we're now turning our lens to another monumental figure, Plato. If you're eager to get straight into the video, you can skip ahead to the timestamp on the screen. However, I recommend sticking around for this quick intro to set the stage for what's to come. This isn't just any short intro to Plato, it's a crash course, breaking down his complex thoughts into digestible insights. It's a fairly long video and we've added timestamps for specific topics, so feel free to navigate to the areas that pique your interest, from his short time as a slave to his categorization of knowledge, which were the bedrock for the modern scientific method, advocating for universal and unchanging truths. And a quick note on God, as mentioned several times in the original text by Diogenes Laertius. It's important to understand that this doesn't refer to the monotheistic God of later Abrahamic religions. Plato's God aligns more with the idea of a demiurge, the divine order of the universe, or a cosmic mind or reason. And if you find these explorations enriching and would like to help us continue to bring these timeless lessons to life, consider supporting us on Patreon. Your support not only fuels this journey through ancient wisdom, but also joins you to a community of like-minded seekers. Without further ado, let's step into the world of Plato and uncover the treasures of thought he left behind. The life and philosophy of Plato. Plato, a proud son of Athens, was born to Ariston and Perictiona, sometimes called Platone. His family tree was nothing short of impressive. His mother was related to the legendary lawmaker Solon. In fact, Solon's brother Dropidas was the start of a lineage that led directly to Plato. This lineage included notable figures like Critias, one of the infamous 30 tyrants, and Glaucon. On his father's side, Plato's ancestors were said to be linked to the ancient kings of Athens, all the way back to the sea god Neptune himself. The story goes that Perictione was incredibly beautiful, and Ariston, smitten by her, tried unsuccessfully to win her over. After giving up his pursuit, Ariston reportedly dreamt of the god Apollo, who advised him to respect Perictione's space until after the birth of their child. Plato came into the world during the 88th Olympiad, specifically on the 7th day of Thargelion, a day believed to be Apollo's birthday as well. The historian Apollodorus is our source for this detail. His journey of life ended during a wedding celebration in the first year of the 108th Olympiad, living either 81 or 84 years, depending on which ancient historian you ask. Plato hailed from the Athenian borough of Colytus. Some tales suggest he was born in Aegina, in the home of Phidiades, as his father had been sent there as a colonist. However, his family returned to Athens after the settlers were expelled by the Spartans. Plato was also involved in the cultural life of Athens, once managing the staging of a play financed by Dion. As for education, he started with Dionysius in literary studies, and then trained in gymnastics with the wrestler Ariston of Argos. It was Ariston who nicknamed him Plato, a nod to his strong, broad physique, though some argue the name came from his broad style of eloquence or his wide forehead. Plato wasn't an only child. He had two brothers, Adimantus and Glaucon, and a sister named Potona, who was the mother of Speusippus. Young Plato was quite the scholar and athlete. He studied under Dionysius, later mentioning him in his work. He trained in wrestling, even competing in the prestigious Isthmian Games, according to some sources. His talents didn't end at philosophy and athletics, though. He dabbled in painting and even explored poetry, starting with dithyrambics before moving on to lyrics and tragedies. Despite his many talents, it's said that Plato had a rather weak voice. Socrates, his mentor, once dreamt of a cygnet on his lap that transformed into a magnificent swan, a vision he believed symbolized Plato's arrival and the profound impact of his teachings. Plato's journey into the world of philosophy began in the vibrant surroundings of the academy. Later, he shifted his musings to a garden near Colonus, a detail Alexander mentions in his Successions, citing Heraclitus as his source. Plato was on the verge of a career in drama, even gearing up to compete in the Dionysian festival with his tragedies. However, an encounter with Socrates dramatically altered his path. Inspired by Socrates' profound discourse, he abandoned his theatrical ambitions, quoting, "Vulcan, come here, for Plato wants your aid." From that moment, at the age of 20, Plato became a dedicated disciple of Socrates. After the tragic loss of his mentor, Plato sought wisdom from various corners. He studied under Cratylus, a follower of Heraclitus, and Hermogenes, who embraced the ideas of Parmenides. At 28, he found refuge in Megara with Euclid, alongside other followers of Socrates. But Plato's thirst for knowledge was unquenchable. he ventured to Cyrene to learn from the mathematician Theodorus, then to Italy to sit at the feet of the Pythagoreans, Philolaus, and Eurytus. His travels even took him to Egypt, where, during a bout of illness, he experienced the healing powers of the sea, echoing the sentiment, "The sea doth wash away all human evils." Plato admired the Egyptians, famously skilled in medicine, and even toyed with the idea of studying with the Magi. However, conflicts in Asia cut that ambition short. Upon his return to Athens, Plato laid down roots in the academy. This lush, grove-like space, named after the ancient hero Hecademus, offered the perfect setting for contemplation and discourse. Eupolis, in his Discharged Soldiers, extols the serene, godly shade of walks in the academy. Timon, too, spoke of Plato with admiration, portraying him as a charismatic figure, eloquent and engaging, likened to a melodic grasshopper perched on Hecademus's tree, singing tirelessly. Plato's academy wasn't just a school. It was a sanctuary for thought, a place where minds converged, forever changing the course of philosophical inquiry. His intellectual pursuits were not confined to solitary contemplation. He was also deeply engaged in the exchange of ideas with contemporaries, including Isocrates. Praxiphanes even documented a dialogue between them, focusing on poets, during a visit to Plato's country residence. Aristoxenus paints Plato not just as a thinker but as a man of action, detailing his participation in three military campaigns, at Tanagra, Corinth, and particularly at Delium, where he was honoured for outstanding bravery. His philosophical approach was a blend of the doctrines of Heraclitus, Pythagoras, and his mentor, Socrates. He explored the realm of the sensory world through Heraclitus's lens, delved into the intellectual sphere with Pythagorean insights, and navigated the complexities of politics guided by Socratic principles. Plato's quest for wisdom was not hindered by financial constraints. Some, like Satyrus, recount how he invested a hefty sum of 100 minae to acquire 3 books of Pythagorean teachings from Philolaus through Dion. This was possible thanks to his comfortable financial status, bolstered by a substantial gift of over 80 talents from Dionysius, a fact also noted by Onetor in his discourse on the financial pursuits of the wise. Plato's work was significantly influenced by the comic playwright Epicharmus, whose ideas he incorporated extensively. Alcimus highlights this in his series of essays to Amyntas, particularly emphasizing the resemblance in their philosophical stances. For instance, both thinkers pondered the nature of sensory objects, noting their constant flux and indefinable essence when stripped of numerical identity. This perspective reflects a profound understanding of the transient, ever-evolving nature of the sensory world, a notion that Plato and Epicharmus explored with great depth and insight. Plato, inspired by Epicharmus, explores how we understand the world in two different ways, through our senses, like seeing or touching, and through our minds, the intellect. He points out that everything we sense is always changing. For example, if you add to or subtract from a number, it becomes a new number. Similarly, if you change the length of something, it's no longer the same thing as before. And just like these examples, people change too. We're constantly growing and evolving, never staying exactly the same from one moment to the next. On the other hand, when it comes to our minds or intellect, there are things that don't change. These are the eternal truths or first principles. They're like the basic rules of the universe that always stay the same, no matter what. For instance, the concept of a perfect circle, or the idea that two contradictory statements can't both be true at the same time, like saying it's raining and it's not raining at the same moment. In other words, Plato and Epicharmus are saying that our world has two parts, the part we experience with our senses, which is always changing, and the part we understand with our minds, where some fundamental truths or first principles never change. They're making us think about the difference between what's always shifting and what's forever constant in our understanding of the world. Likewise, Alcimus, reflecting on the teachings of the wise, notes that the soul understands the world in two ways, through the body and through its own power. When we see or hear, it's the soul perceiving through the body. However, the soul can also grasp things independently, using its own capabilities. This understanding leads to the idea that everything can be categorized into two groups: things we perceive with our senses, like sights and sounds, and things we understand with our minds, like concepts and ideas. Plato took this further. He suggested that if you really want to grasp the fundamentals of everything, you should start by separating out certain ideas or concepts. These include things like similarity, unity, multitude, size, stillness, and motion. Next, Plato believed you should think about moral and ethical concepts like goodness, justice, and honor on their own, without mixing them up with other ideas. Finally, consider how some concepts are related to each other, like knowledge, size, or power. We understand these things based on their nature and give names to objects that share their characteristics. For example, we call something just because it shares in the concept of justice. Plato saw these primary concepts or ideas as eternal truths that exist beyond our physical world. They can only be understood with the mind and aren't influenced by external factors. He likened these ideas to models or templates, suggesting that everything in our world is a copy or reflection of these eternal truths. Epicharmus also delved into this concept, particularly with the idea of goodness. He used the example of flute playing to illustrate it. Flute playing exists as a concept, but a man isn't the act of flute playing. Similarly, someone who learns to play the flute becomes a flute player, not the concept of flute playing itself. The same goes for goodness. The concept of good exists independently, and someone who learns about goodness becomes good, but doesn't become the concept of goodness itself. This distinction is crucial in understanding how we relate to concepts and ideas in our world. Plato's theory of ideas, as detailed here, delves into the essence of memory and its relation to eternal truths or ideas. He argues that memory focuses on what is stable and enduring, and the only things that truly endure are these ideas. He poses the question, how could animals survive if they had no guiding ideas and no natural intellect? Animals remember and recognize things like their kind of food or their own species because they have an innate understanding of similarity. This natural ability is what guides them through life. Epicharmus adds another layer to this discussion by emphasizing that wisdom and intellect are not exclusive to humans, but are present in all living creatures. He illustrates this with the example of a hen in a poultry yard. A hen doesn't initially give birth to living chicks, but sits on her eggs and warms them into life. This instinctive wisdom is a gift from nature, serving as both her guide and teacher. Epicharmus further explains how creatures perceive beauty and worth within their own species, highlighting a subjective view of beauty and attraction that varies from one species to another. This perspective underlines the innate natural understanding present in all living beings, regardless of their level of complexity. Alcimus, in his four books, explores these ideas in depth, showcasing how Plato's philosophical concepts were significantly influenced by Epicharmus. The influence is so pronounced that Epicharmus himself, aware of his intellectual contribution, foretells a future where his ideas will be remembered and reinterpreted. He envisions someone rephrasing his thoughts, presenting them in a new grandeur fashion, and commanding respect and admiration for these reimagined ideas. Plato was known not just for his philosophical works, but also for his appreciation of literature. He is credited with bringing the works of Sophron, a writer of mimes, to Athens. These works were somewhat overlooked before Plato recognized their value, especially in his own ethical and moral musings. Interestingly, a copy of Sophron's works was reportedly found under Plato's pillow after he passed away, indicating the deep influence these writings had on him. Plato's first journey to Sicily was an adventure filled with intellectual debate and danger. Invited by Dionysius, the ruler of Sicily, Plato engaged in discussions about governance. He argued that a government benefits only when the ruler is virtuous. This stance didn't sit well with Dionysius, who insulted Plato. Plato's sharp retort likened Dionysius's words to those of a tyrant, which enraged Dionysius further. Initially, Dionysius wanted to execute Plato, but eventually decided to sell him into slavery instead. He was sold in Aegina, where he faced the threat of execution due to a local law against Athenians. However, his life took a fortunate turn when he was recognized as a philosopher, leading to his release. Some accounts suggest he was ransomed by Anicerus, a Cyrenian, for a considerable sum. His friends in Athens tried to repay Anicerus, but he refused the money, stating that caring for Plato wasn't only their privilege. Others say Dion was the one who paid the ransom and used the returned money to buy Plato the garden in the academy. Polus, the man who sold Plato, later faced misfortune, believed by some to be divine retribution for his actions against Plato. Plato's second visit to Sicily was under the rule of the younger Dionysius. Here, Plato sought land and people to create a society based on his philosophical principles. Although Dionysius promised to fulfill this request, he never did. Plato found himself in danger, suspected of inciting a rebellion, but was saved by a letter from Archytas, a Pythagorean philosopher, which pleaded for Plato's safe return to Athens. The letter reminded Dionysius of his initial enthusiasm for Plato's visit and his promises of hospitality and safety. Archytas appealed to Dionysius's sense of justice and humanity, urging him to honour their agreement and return Plato unharmed, a plea that ultimately secured Plato's safe passage back to Athens. Plato's third and final journey to Sicily was an attempt to mend the strained relationship between Dion and Dionysius. Despite his efforts, he was unable to reconcile the two and return to Athens, his efforts unfortunately fruitless. Back in Athens, Plato refrained from active participation in politics, although his writings were deeply political. The prevailing political landscape was at odds with his own philosophies and ideals. Pamphile, in his extensive writings, mentions that Plato was once offered the opportunity to legislate for a new city being founded by the Arcadians and Thebans. However, Plato declined the offer, realizing that the citizens would not agree to his principle of equal rights. Despite his general avoidance of politics, Plato did step into the legal arena to defend Chabrias, a general facing serious charges, at a time when no other citizen dared to do so. Confronted by Crobylus, a notorious sycophant, with a reminder of the fate that befell Socrates, Plato bravely retorted that just as he had faced dangers on the battlefield for his country, he was now prepared to face risks for justice and in defence of a friend. Plato was a pioneer in many areas. He was the first to write treatises in the form of dialogues and to introduce the analytical method of investigation, instructing others like Leodamus of Tharsus. His contributions spanned various domains of philosophy and science, including discussions on antipodes, elements, dialectics, and more. He was the first to scientifically explore grammar and to counter the assertions of Lysias, meticulously addressing them in his work, Phaedrus. His extensive influence and willingness to challenge previous thinkers raise questions about why he never mentioned Democritus, another prominent philosopher of his time. Plato's fame was widespread. Neanthes of Cyzicus recounts how at the Olympic Games, Plato's presence commanded the attention of all the Greeks present. It was during these games that he had a significant discussion with Dion about the latter's plans against Dionysius. Further solidifying his legacy, Mithridates the Persian erected a statue in Plato's honour in the Academy, a testament to the philosopher's profound impact across cultures and regions, celebrated by an inscription from Mithridates himself. Heraclides paints a picture of a young Plato as the epitome of modesty and self-control. Remarkably, he was never observed to laugh excessively, showcasing a demeanour of seriousness and restraint even in his youth. Despite Plato's solemn character, he wasn't spared from the playful jabs of comic poets. Theopompus, in his play Pleasure Seeker, jests about Plato's philosophical ideas, highlighting the complexity and often perplexing nature of his thoughts. Anaxandrides, in Theseus, pokes fun at Plato's eating habits, while Timon humorously criticizes Plato's writings by playing on the word platitudes. Alexis, in his works Meropis and Ancilion, depicts Plato as a figure of contemplation and perplexity, wandering aimlessly in search of elusive truths. Amphis, in Amphicrates and Dexidemides, continues this theme, portraying Plato as a figure deeply engrossed in thought, often to the point of seeming disconnected from the practical world. Cratinus, in Pseudi Ptolemaeus, alludes to Plato's wisdom, but also his tendency to express doubt and scepticism. Alexis, again in Olympiodorus, refers to Plato's philosophical views on the duality of the human soul, contrasting the mortal body with the immortal spirit. In Parasite, Alexis paints Plato as a solitary thinker, often lost in his own world of contemplation. Anaxilus, in his plays Batrillion, Circe, and Rich Women, also joins in on the humour, although the specifics of his jests are not detailed here. Plato's life wasn't just about profound philosophical discourses. He also had deep personal relationships and a flair for poetry. Aristippus notes Plato's attachment to a young man named Astor, who shared his interest in astronomy, and to Dion, whose relationship with Plato is well documented. Plato's affection for these individuals, as well as for others like Phaedrus and Alexis, is immortalized in a series of touching epigrams. These short poems reveal a tender side of Plato, showcasing his capacity for deep emotional connections and his poetic talent. In his verses for Astor, Plato expresses a longing to be the heavens themselves, to look upon Astor with many eyes. His words after Asta's death transform this longing into a poignant memory, comparing Asta's earthly presence to the morning star and his afterlife to the evening star. For Dion, Plato's verses speak of a destined sorrow for the Trojans, paralleling Dion's life with a tragic yet noble narrative. Dion is portrayed as a figure of hope and honour, deeply mourned by Plato and his countrymen, with an epigram inscribed on Dion's tomb in Syracuse as a testament to their bond. Plato's affection for Alexis and Phaedrus is captured in a reflective epigram, lamenting their absence and the futility of longing. Another piece for a mistress named Archianassa highlights the power of beauty, even in its waning years, and the overwhelming impact it can have on those who behold it. His verse for Agathon is a vivid portrayal of love's intensity, where Plato describes his soul as trying to bridge the gap between them through a kiss. In another, he uses the metaphor of an apple to express love's fragility and the fleeting nature of beauty. Plato's epigrams extend beyond personal relationships, however, to comment on broader themes, such as the tragic fate of the Eretrians or the muse's defiance of Cupid's influence. He even delves into the irony of a person stealing gold, only for it to be replaced by a noose. Plato, despite his brilliance, wasn't without his critics and rivals. Molon couldn't fathom why Plato would be in Sicily, hinting at some controversy surrounding his visits there. Xenophon, another illustrious thinker, seemed to have a complex relationship with Plato. They both penned works with similar themes and titles, almost as if in competition. Despite their mutual focus on Socrates, they barely acknowledged each other, except for a singular mention of Plato by Xenophon. Plato's interactions weren't always harmonious either. His exchange with Antisthenes over a philosophical argument turned sour, leading to a lasting animosity between them. Socrates himself reportedly criticized Plato for attributing words to him that he never spoke, a claim that hints at the tension between preserving Socrates' legacy and interpreting his thoughts. His disdain wasn't limited to rivals of thought either. He was openly critical of Aristippus and Aeschines, the latter of whom suffered from a fall from grace and Plato's apparent disregard. The attribution of Crito's speech to Aeschines by Idomeneus points to the intricate web of personal and intellectual conflicts surrounding Plato. Plato's works, residing between the realms of poetry and prose, elicited mixed reactions. Notable was the incident where Aristotle, among all listeners, was the only one to stay until the end of Plato's reading on the soul, highlighting the challenging nature of his discourse. His treatises, particularly The Republic, underwent constant revisions, reflecting his relentless pursuit of perfection and clarity. Yet, critics like Dicaeacus didn't shy away from pointing out what they perceived as flaws, emphasizing the rawness of his early compositions. Plato's life was filled with insightful incidents and teachings. His reprimand to a man playing dice, his contemplations on the nature of fame and monuments, and his refusal to discipline in anger all reflect his profound understanding of human nature and behavior. His disdain for excessive indulgence, be it in sleep or alcohol, was evident in his teachings and personal habits. His views on truth, beautifully articulated in his laws, underscore his deep commitment to this fundamental virtue, emphasizing both its beauty and its rarity in convincing the minds of men. Through these glimpses into his life and interactions, Plato emerges not just as a towering figure in philosophy, but as a man deeply engaged with the world around him, navigating the complexities of human relationships, intellectual rivalries, and the relentless pursuit of wisdom and truth. Plato was keen on leaving a lasting legacy, either through the profound impact on his friends or the timeless wisdom encapsulated in his writings. His desire was to etch his teachings and thoughts in the minds and hearts of those he interacted with and the readers of his works. Plato wasn't just confined to Athens. He was known for his travels, an aspect of his life that some authors emphasize, suggesting that his quest for knowledge and inspiration took him beyond familiar territories. His death, as mentioned earlier, occurred during Philip of Macedon's 13th year of reign, a fact noted by Favorinus. The circumstances of his death sparked some peculiar rumors, including a satirical comment about lice from Philo, as mentioned by Myronianus, indicating that even in death, Plato wasn't free from the sharp tongues of his contemporaries. Plato found his eternal peace in the Academy, the very place where his thoughts had blossomed and his teachings had flourished, surrounded by the students who revered him. His will was a testament to his meticulous nature, ensuring his possessions, land, and beloved slaves were accounted for and entrusted to his son, Adeimantus. Poetic tributes adorned his tomb, echoing the respect, love, and admiration he garnered. One such tribute, celebrating his virtuous life and unparalleled wisdom, goes like this. Here lies Aristocles, first in pure virtue's fame. If wisdom had a peak, he went beyond the same. Another tribute speaks of his ascension and universal reverence. It goes like this. In tender earth great Plato's form may rest, but his soul soars with gods eternally blessed. From far and wide in love and honour all hold dear, his life, divine and pure, a legacy without peer. And my own verse highlights Plato's role as a divine gift to humanity. Had Phoebus not graced us with Plato's mind, how would the learned god have us refined? He sent him forth not just to heal or to mend, but as a sage for the soul, an eternal friend. Other verses encapsulate his impact, comparing him to Aesculapius for his ability to heal the mind and spirit, and painting his transition from a mortal realm to a utopian existence amongst the divine. Plato was not just a philosopher, he was a teacher whose ideas reached and shaped a wide array of students. His classroom was a mix of minds from different corners of the world. Notable among his students were Speusippus, Xenocrates, and the famous Aristotle, who later became a star in the world of philosophy. Plato's reach wasn't limited to men. His circle of students also included Lasthenia of Mantinea and Axiothea of Phlius, who notably adopted male attire. The inclusion of thinkers like Theophrastus, Hyperides, and possibly even Demosthenes as his pupils underscores the extensive influence of Plato's philosophical teachings. Other students, such as Philip of Opus, Histiaeus of Perinthus, and Dion of Syracuse, show how Plato's ideas travelled and took root far beyond Athens. Plato was a master of the dialogue, a style of writing that involves characters discussing big ideas in a conversational format. While Zeno or Alexamenus might have been the pioneers of dialogical writing, it was Plato who refined and perfected this form. His dialogues are more than just chats. They're carefully crafted explorations of big topics like philosophy and politics. In these dialogues, characters are well thought out and the language is chosen carefully to fit the discussion. These dialogues are characterized by a meticulous approach to character portrayal and language selection, reflective of Plato's profound understanding of human nature and societal dynamics. The heart of Plato's dialogues is dialectics, a term for a structured debate where questions and answers help uncover truths. These dialogues come in different flavors. Some guide the reader through big-picture natural and logical thinking about the universe. Some are ethical and political themes on how to live a good life. Others still are about investigating ideas, either through practical exercises or more argumentative discussions. Plato's works cover a wide range of topics. Some, like Timaeus, dig into natural philosophy, how the world works, while others, like Republic and Laws, delve into how societies should be run. Each dialogue has its unique style and focus, showcasing Plato's versatility and depth as a thinker. The dialogues are further classified into different types, each serving a unique purpose and offering insights into Plato's multifaceted approach to philosophy. From the dramatic and narrative to those focusing on natural philosophy, logical analysis, or ethical considerations, Plato's dialogues represent a monumental achievement in the history of philosophical thought. There's been a lot of debate about Plato's dialogues, specifically about whether he's firmly stating his own beliefs or just exploring ideas. When people talk about dogmatizing, meaning confidently stating something as true, much like a teacher might lay down the rules in a classroom, Plato, however, isn't just laying down the law in his writings, he's doing something more complex and thoughtful. In his dialogues, Plato often presents his own beliefs through the voices of characters like Socrates and Timaeus. They're like his spokespersons, expressing his own considered opinions. But Plato doesn't just talk about what he believes. He also tackles ideas he disagrees with. To do this, he introduces characters who represent these opposing views, like Thrasymachus or Gorgias. Through these characters, he can show the weaknesses in their arguments. Plato loves using a method called inductive reasoning, which is about starting with specific examples and moving towards a general conclusion. But he doesn't stick to just one way of doing this. He uses two types, one that deals with opposites and another that builds from specific cases to a broader understanding. The first type involves setting up a question in such a way that no matter how you answer it, the outcome contradicts the initial assumption. Plato uses this clever technique not to push his own ideas, but to challenge and break down the arguments of others. The second type of inductive reasoning is split further into two. The first is like a courtroom strategy, where you focus on specific details, like proving someone committed a crime because they were spotted at the scene. This style is more about dealing with specific situations than figuring out universal truths. The second is more philosophical, where you start with specific examples and use them to establish a broader truth. Plato uses this approach when he discusses big ideas, like whether the soul lives on after death. He starts with specific observations and uses them to support a larger general idea. Just like how ancient plays evolved from simple performances to complex productions with multiple actors, philosophy also developed over time. At first, philosophy mainly talked about the natural world. Then, Socrates added another layer by thinking deeply about ethics, or how we should live our lives. Plato took it a step further by introducing dialectics, a way of discussing and understanding complex ideas by asking and answering questions. This made philosophy complete, covering not just the natural world and ethics, but also how we think and argue about big questions. Plato's works were organized much like how playwrights put together a series of four plays for festivals. He wrote a total of 56 dialogues, including his famous works Republic, with 10 parts, and Laws, with 12 parts. These were grouped into 9 sets, each with 4 dialogues connected by common themes, much like a series of plays. Each set of dialogues or series explores different areas of life and thought. For example, the first series starts with Euthyphron, a dialogue about what is sacred or holy, and includes discussions about Socrates' defense, what actions are right, and the nature of the soul. These dialogues focus a lot on moral issues, thinking about what's right and wrong. Other series explore different topics. Some talk about language, knowledge, and what truly exists. Others discuss pleasure, what is good, and love. Plato dives into personal topics like courage, friendship, and self-control, as well as big picture ideas about how society should work, the nature of law, and how to run a state. His work is like a grand journey through different areas of philosophy. He doesn't just talk about one thing. He covers a lot of ground, from personal morals to how societies should be organized. This makes his collection of dialogues a rich and varied exploration of human life and the world around us, inviting us to think deeply about many different topics. Plato's intellectual legacy wasn't confined to his dialogues, though. He also penned a collection of 13 letters, each a reflection of his moral teachings, akin to how Epicurus and Cleon inscribed their works with guiding principles. These letters, diverse in their recipients and content, offer a more personal glimpse into Plato's thoughts and relationships, addressing figures like Aristodemus, Archytas, Dionysius, and others. The letters were moral in nature and add another layer to our understanding of Plato's philosophy, revealing the human connections behind his profound intellectual pursuits. People have tried different ways to organize Plato's writings. Some, like Aristophanes the Grammarian, grouped them into sets of 3 called trilogies. This way, each set of 3 dialogues talks about similar things. For example, one trilogy has Republic, Timaeus, and Critias together because they all explore similar themes. Different experts have their own favorite starting points for reading Plato's works. Some say start with Republic, others say Greater Alcibiades, or even Theages. But everyone agrees that some dialogues weren't really written by Plato. Works like Maidon or Alcyon were probably written by others, showing that it's sometimes hard to know which writings are truly Plato's. Plato was a master at using language in a special way. He used words to talk about really deep and complex ideas. Sometimes he'd use the same word in different ways to make his readers think more about what he was saying. For example, he used the word wise to talk about someone who understands deep truths, but also about someone who's good at a certain job or skill. In his writings, Plato would use opposite words to talk about the same thing, showing how complicated and ever-changing our world is. He had lots of different words to talk about big ideas, like idea, form, genus, or archetype, showing there's more than one way to think about these things. To really get what Plato is saying, you have to think about 3 things. What each thing he says means, why he's saying it, is it his own idea, or is he arguing against someone else, and if what he's saying is actually true. This way of reading Plato's work makes us think hard and dive deep into his complex world of ideas. Plato's books are unique not just for the ideas they present, but also for the special symbols he used, sort of like hidden notes for the reader. These marks have specific meanings. For instance, a simple X marks special words or phrases that are typical of Plato's writing style. If you see two X symbols together, that's Plato highlighting his main ideas or beliefs. A dotted X is used for parts of the text that are exceptionally well written. If something's marked with both a double X and dots, that means it's a correction or an update to the text. A dotted obelus is a sign that Plato might not fully agree with that part. Certain passages that can be understood in more than one way, or where the words are swapped around for effect, are marked with a special dotted symbol. The Cyrenian symbol links together different philosophical ideas, sort of like a thread that ties complex thoughts together. An asterisk is a sign that Plato agrees with the idea, while an obelus shows he's rejecting or removing some part of the text. These unique markings in his books aren't just for show, they help readers dive deeper into Plato's thinking and style. Interestingly, owning these books when they were first released was quite valuable and attracted many eager readers. Plato had some big ideas about life, the soul, and everything in the universe. He believed that our souls live forever, moving through different bodies over time. He thought that everything starts with something simple he called number. For Plato, the soul wasn't just one thing, it had three parts. The part that thinks and reasons lives in our head. The part that feels strong emotions like love or anger is around our heart. And the part that desires or wants things is near our stomach. He pictured the soul as sitting right in the middle of our body, touching every part of it. He also imagined the soul as having two main circles or loops. One loop is about things that are always the same, like truths that never change. The other loop is about things that can change, like our feelings or the seasons. The first loop, the unchanging one, is more important and higher up because it's about constant truths. The second loop is about the changing, shifting parts of life. These two loops of the soul work together. The unchanging loop helps us understand and make sense of the world. It takes what we see and experience and finds the deeper, unchanging truths. The changing loop helps us form opinions and views based on what's happening around us. Plato's philosophy rests on two fundamental pillars, God and matter, the physical substance of the universe. He sees matter as a shapeless, limitless entity from which all things are formed. According to Plato, the universe started as a chaotic jumble until God brought order, valuing an organized cosmos over chaos. He divides this ordered universe into four basic elements: fire, water, air, and earth. Each element has a unique symbol. Fire is a pyramid, air is an octahedron, water is an icosahedron, and earth is a cube. Earth stands out as the only unchangeable element due to its unique structure. These elements aren't isolated. They're compacted together by the universe's spherical motion, constantly changing and exchanging positions. Plato also believes the world is a singular, created entity that's perceivable by our senses. He sees it as a living being, crafted by the finest creator, God. The world, according to Plato, mirrors the best. It's perfect, spherical, and comprehensive, containing all other life forms and the deity itself. It's smooth and lacks appendages because it needs nothing external. Though it's formed by fire, water, air, and earth, the world remains indestructible, a testament to the goodness and supremacy of its divine creator. In Plato's view, time is the moving image of eternity, moving along with the heavens. Days, nights, months, these are all segments of time, inseparable from the universe's existence. He assigns specific roles to celestial bodies like the sun and moon. They're there to measure time and help living beings understand the concept of number. The universe, in Plato's eyes, is alive, teeming with motion and life. It's perfect and resembles an intelligible living being. Since God embodies life, the universe too must be alive, hosting various forms of life. God's predominantly made of fire, creatures of the air, sea, and land. The earth, revered as the oldest deity, plays a crucial role in the cycle of day and night, its central position keeping it in constant motion around the center. Plato acknowledges two types of causes, intellect-driven and necessity-driven. Necessary causes like air, fire, earth, and water aren't pure elements but rather containers forming and dissolving into triangles. These two causes, along with the models of God and matter, underpin everything in the universe. Before the world's creation, these causes existed but lacked order. However, once the universe came into being, they gained structure and regularity. Plato believed that the ultimate goal in life is to become like God. He thought that virtue alone could lead to happiness, but it's even better if you have physical and material advantages to help you along the way. These could be good health, strength, clear senses, wealth, high social status or fame. Yet, even without these, a wise person could still lead a happy life. Plato felt that a wise person would respect the laws of their country and even make laws if they could, unless the political situation was too chaotic due to people's conflicts. He also believed that the gods watch over human affairs and that there are beings like spirits or demons. Plato was the first to outline the concept of what is honourable, tying it to what's praiseworthy, logical, useful, fitting, and in line with nature. In his dialogues, Plato was meticulous about the correctness of terms, making him the first to turn the art of asking and answering questions into a science. He used this method extensively, ensuring his philosophical discussions were clear and precise. He spoke of justice as something sacred, almost like a divine law that encourages people to act rightly to avoid punishment after death. This perspective led some to think he was fond of myths, as he often mixed mythical stories with his philosophical writings. The idea was to use the uncertainty about life after death to motivate people to steer clear of wrongdoing. According to Aristotle, Plato categorized goodness into three groups: mind, body, and external. Virtues like justice and courage belong to the soul. Physical attributes like beauty and health reside in the body. External goods include friends, a country's prosperity, and wealth. So, there are goods of the soul, the body, and those external to both. Plato identified three kinds of friendship: natural, companionship-based, and hospitality-based. Natural friendship is what parents feel for their children, or what relatives feel for each other, a bond shared by humans and animals alike. Friendship from companionship is not bound by blood, but by shared experiences, like the friendship between Pylades and Orestes. Hospitality-based friendship arises from agreements between strangers and is maintained through communication. Some even add a fourth type, the friendship of love. Plato outlined five forms of government: democracy, aristocracy, oligarchy, monarchy, and tyranny. In a democracy, the majority rules, choosing leaders and making laws. An aristocracy is led by the noble born. Oligarchy is ruled by the few, usually the wealthy. Monarchy can be based on law or family, like in Carthage, Sparta, or Macedonia. And tyranny is when people are tricked or forced into being ruled by one person. Each form of government comes with its own dynamics and challenges. He believed that justice takes three distinct forms, depending on who it's directed towards. The first form deals with the gods. People show this when they follow religious laws and respect temples. The second form is justice towards other people. This is seen when someone returns a loan or keeps a promise. The third form is justice towards the dead, demonstrated by showing proper respect to their resting places. In essence, Plato saw justice as a multifaceted concept that extends to our relationships with the gods, the living, and the dead. According to Plato, knowledge can be practical, productive, or theoretical. Practical knowledge involves activities that don't produce a physical object, like playing an instrument or managing state affairs. Productive knowledge results in tangible outcomes, like building houses or ships. Theoretical knowledge doesn't lead to action or production, but involves deep thinking about things like mathematics, music, or astronomy. Plato divided medical science into five categories: pharmaceutical, manual, dietetic, diagnostic, and remedial. The pharmaceutical branch deals with medicine, the manual with surgery, the dietetic with lifestyle and dietary adjustments, the diagnostic with identifying diseases, and the remedial with providing immediate relief from suffering. Law, according to Plato, comes in two forms: written and unwritten. Written law includes the official rules that govern societies, while unwritten law consists of social customs and norms that aren't formally documented but are still followed. He also identified five types of discourse. Political discourse happens in public debates. Rhetorical discourse is used in speeches and written works for display or persuasion. And private discourse occurs in everyday conversations. Dialectic discourse involves a back-and-forth questioning style, while professional discourse is used by experts discussing their specific fields. Music, in Plato's view, comes in three forms: vocal, singing, instrumental and vocal combined, like singing with a harp, and purely instrumental, like playing the harp. In Plato's view, nobility can arise from four sources: 1, having virtuous, brave, and just ancestors; 2, coming from a lineage of rulers or princes; 3, descending from ancestors known for their personal achievements, like winning games or being great generals; or 4, possessing noble qualities oneself. In other words, nobility can be inherited through family, personal achievements, or one's own character. Plato believed beauty comes in three forms. The first is aesthetic beauty, like that of a beautiful face, which we praise and admire. The second is functional beauty, found in useful objects like tools or houses, appreciated for their practicality. The third is the beauty of laws and customs, valued for their benefit to society. So, beauty can be admired for its looks, usefulness, or its contribution to orderly living. Plato divided the soul into three sections: the reasoning part, the appetitive part, and the passionate part. The reasoning part is responsible for thinking and understanding. The appetitive part drives our basic desires like hunger or the need for companionship. The passionate part is where our emotions come from, like joy, anger, or grief. Each part plays a distinct role in shaping our thoughts, feelings, and actions. In Plato's view, a perfectly virtuous soul has four qualities: prudence, justice, courage, and temperance. Prudence helps in making wise decisions. Justice ensures fairness in dealings with others. Courage allows standing firm in the face of danger, and temperance keeps desires in check, leading to a disciplined life. Leadership, according to Plato, can be based on law, nature, custom, family, or force. Legal leadership is chosen by the people. Natural leadership follows the general rule of males leading females. Customary leadership is like teachers guiding students. Family-based leadership is seen in hereditary monarchies like Sparta. And forceful leadership is when rulers control through intimidation or deceit. Plato identified six rhetorical styles. Exhortation encourages action, like going to war. Dissuasion advises against action, like maintaining peace. Accusation is blaming someone for wrongdoing, while defense is arguing innocence. Encomium is praising someone's virtues, and blame is criticizing someone's actions or character. Speaking correctly involves four principles: saying the right thing, what's beneficial, saying it in the right amount, neither too much nor too little, saying it to the right people, using appropriate language for the audience, and saying it at the right time, neither too early nor too late. Each principle ensures that speech is effective, considerate, and appropriate. Plato believed kindness could be shown in four ways: through money, through personal effort, with knowledge, and with words. Giving money to those in need is one form of kindness. Helping someone physically, like aiding someone who is being attacked, is another. A third way is sharing knowledge, whether by teaching or healing. Finally, speaking up for someone in need, like defending them in court, is a way to show kindness through words. According to Plato, every situation or affair can have one of four types of endings. A situation can end according to law, like when a legal decision is made. It can end according to nature, like the natural conclusion of a day or a year. It can end according to art, like when a building is completed or a ship is constructed. Lastly, an event can end by chance, when things don't go as expected. Plato identified four types of power: intellectual, physical, societal, and situational. Intellectual power comes from our ability to think and understand. Physical power stems from our bodily abilities, like walking or lifting. Societal power is derived from having many followers or a lot of wealth. Situational power involves being in situations where we can influence others or are influenced by them, like being taught or being healthy. He saw three forms of philanthropy or love for humanity. The first is expressed in friendly greetings and gestures, like shaking hands or smiling at everyone you meet. The second is a willingness to help those in trouble. And the third is about being a good companion, making others happy through companionship and celebration. For Plato, happiness consists of five elements: wise decision-making, good physical health, good luck, a good reputation, and wealth. Wisdom comes from learning and experience. Physical health means your senses and body are functioning well. Good luck is about successfully doing what's right. A good reputation is being spoken well of by others. And wealth means having enough resources to help friends and fulfill social duties. Plato categorized arts into three groups. The first group includes basic arts like mining and lumberjacking, which prepare raw materials. The second group involves transforming these materials, like metalworking and carpentry. The third group uses the products of the first two groups, like horsemanship using bridles, military arts using weapons, and music using instruments. These categories show how arts can be classified based on their role in the process of creation and utilization. Plato identified four different types of good. The first is related to personal virtue, like when we call someone a good person because of their moral qualities. The second type is when we talk about virtue and justice themselves as good. The third type of good involves things that are beneficial for us, like healthy food or exercise. The fourth type is about being skilled in something, like being good at playing the flute or acting. According to Plato, things can be bad, good, or neutral. Bad things are always harmful, like foolishness or injustice. Their opposites, like wisdom or justice, are good. Then there are neutral things, which can be either beneficial or harmful depending on the situation, like walking or eating, or they might have no impact on us at all. So, some things are inherently bad or good, while others are neutral or not clearly one or the other. Plato believed that a good state of affairs in terms of laws can be seen in three ways. First, when the laws themselves are good. Second, when citizens faithfully follow the laws. And third, when there are no formal laws, but people still act rightly because of customs and established practices. Similarly, lawlessness can manifest in three ways: bad laws, disobedience to existing laws, and the complete absence of laws. Contraries or opposites come in three types. The first is the contrast between good and evil, like justice versus injustice. The second type is when one bad thing is the opposite of another, like being too extravagant versus being too stingy. The third type involves neutral things, neither good nor bad, like heavy versus light or fast versus slow. So, contraries can exist between good and evil, among bad qualities, or among neutral qualities. Plato categorized good things into three groups. Some goods can be owned, like good health or justice. Some can be shared, like participating in the common good, which can't be owned by a single person. And some goods are about being, not having, or sharing. These are qualities that should exist within a person, like being virtuous or just. You can't possess these or share them in the same way as the other goods, but they are still essential parts of a good life. Plato believed that good counsel can be based on the past, present, or future. Counsel from the past uses historical examples, like the consequences of past decisions. Present-based counsel looks at the current situation, like assessing the strength of fortifications or the morale of soldiers. And future-focused counsel considers the long-term implications of actions, like maintaining a good reputation by treating ambassadors well. Voice, according to Plato, comes in two forms, animated and inanimate. Animated voices come from living beings, like humans and animals. Inanimate voices are sounds or echoes that don't originate from living creatures. Furthermore, animated voices can be expressed through written letters, like human speech, or not, like animal sounds. So there's a voice that's alive and one that's not. Plato categorized things into divisible and indivisible. Indivisible things, like a point or a sound, don't have separate parts and aren't formed by combining other things. Divisible things can be broken down further. Some divisible things, like water or gold, consist of similar parts. Others, like a house, consist of dissimilar parts. So some things can be split into parts and others can't. Some things exist independently, meaning they don't need extra explanation, like a man or a horse. Other things have a relative existence, meaning they're understood in relation to something else, like bigger than or faster than. So some things stand alone, while others are defined by their relationship to something else. There were several individuals named Plato. Besides the renowned philosopher, there was Plato of Rhodes, a philosopher and student of Panaetius. Another Plato was a peripatetic philosopher and a student of Aristotle. There was also a Plato who studied under Praxiphanes, and one more known for his work in Old Comedy. So the name Plato was shared by various figures in different fields of philosophy and art. As we wrap up our journey through Plato's profound insights, I hope you've found a spark of wisdom to carry into your own life. It's been a privilege to navigate these ancient waters with you, exploring thoughts that have withstood the test of time. If you find value in these deep dives and wish to see more, your support on Patreon is the wind beneath our wings. It not only helps us to continue unraveling the mysteries of great minds, but also brings together a community passionate about understanding the complexities of life, one philosopher at a time. Before you go, I'd love to hear your reflections. What resonated with you the most, or perhaps there's another philosopher's realm you're curious to venture into? Drop your thoughts in the comments. Your engagement is the heartbeat of our channel. Until next time, keep pondering, keep exploring, and remember, every step into the past is a leap towards understanding ourselves and the world around us a little better. If you enjoyed this video, you should watch this one next.